Well, hello there, and welcome to the story of us, from cosmic dawn to the depths of being. I'm your host, Jeff Ellison, and boy, do I have a story to share with you today. On this episode, we're joined by a very remarkable human. His name's Todd Lanham. I've known Todd and his wife, Stephanie, for, 15 years now. Todd and I served together on the Salvation Army Advisory Board and have stayed in contact through business and also a shared common love of University of Kentucky sports. In many ways, my friendship with Todd is a testament to some of the most positive aspects of social media. Through Facebook and Instagram accounts, we followed along with each other, and I've got to witness Todd's life and his passion for his family, his wife and their three kids, McKenna, Sawyer, and Hudson. The downside to relationships like these, though, is that they are so often stuck and remain very surface level. When I reached out to Todd and I asked him to be on our show, my hope was to change that. And man, so glad I asked, and I'm even more grateful that he said yes. Like all humans, Todd is so much more complex when we take a few minutes to deeply listen. Sure, he may be internet famous for his work as the Lou Guru on Instagram, but the most compelling content lies in the rich tapestry of his first 50-year story. For this episode, Todd's agreed to very courageously sit down and share his personal story with us. It's a story that begins as one of three siblings growing up on his father and uncle's shared family farm in rural Springfield, Kentucky in the 1980s. You'll hear tales of raising ostriches and hedgehogs, riding along in the combine as the sun sets over the fields, falling head over heels in love with and sharing a life with a beautiful young woman who he happened to meet while pumping gas at a full-service gas station. You'll learn about the difficulties a father has raising kids on a farm during the depressions of the 1980s, and how this led to a few stints in prison for his dad. You'll hear him talk of those mentors in his life, his professor at EKU, and his grandma, those guides that stepped into his life and nudged him towards greatness. At 50, Todd's learning, like me, to be a little more vulnerable, let his guard down, and take time to reflect on how his upbringing molded him into the man he is today. A man dedicated to fatherhood. A man who's had a life marked by resilience and devastating loss, and who has learned how to use grief as fuel for a life well lived. Todd's story is inspirational to me, and I hope one of you out there can take something very meaningful away from our episode today. Whether you're battling your weight, or you're struggling with chronic health issues, fighting to break free from small-town America, or grappling with raising children in today's world, Todd has some wisdom to share with you. Let's jump in and let Todd tell you his story and how he has dedicated this next chapter of his life to making the small things the big things. To learn more about some of the topics you hear on today's show, or to download the smooth, soulful tunes of rising new artist Anthony Melange, please reference the podcast notes for links I've shared. Let's hear Todd. Todd?
That's me.
Welcome to the story of us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I really appreciate you agreeing to sit down with us as, you know, together we explore what it means to be human through the stories we tell, the struggles we carry, the connections that bind us across time. I can't believe it. I've known you for a while now.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. It's been 15, 20 years. It goes by fast.
Yeah, it sure does. I think we got introduced through your wife, Stephanie, at some point because I was doing some work with Norton Healthcare.
Yeah.
But our paths just kind of continued to cross. You randomly lived right next door in Lake Forest to two of our closest friends. And we got to serve together on the board at the Salvation Army.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I think we've done some business together, too, over the years.
Yeah, we've done some business together. We've celebrated some UK wins and probably commenced or had some couple beers about sorrows and had a lot of common interests together. But, yeah, we always seem to find a way to weave in together life and come back to each other.
Now, I tell you, it's amazing to look back and realize that, you know, I've gotten to know you a little. I think, you know, honestly, like anything else, it's a little bit surface level, but I've been following along with your life on social media, and social media is challenging to say the least. And yeah, I think there's a lot of negative about it, but one of the positives is that I've got to watch you and your family kind of grow up over the years on social media. You've been really good about posting stuff there. And I got to say, my wife, Jessica, for years, she will comment to me, I think she's really jealous. She's like, do the Lanhams ever eat dinner at home?
The answer is no. Rarely do we ever eat at home.
So when I asked you to be on this show, it was because I had posted a blog post called Under Pressure, Coping with the Weight of 50. And you took the time to comment on it, and I could tell that it resonated with you. I also wanted to see if you wanted to promote a really cool side project that you have called Lou Guru, which yep, I think has almost 7,000 followers on Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. It was started in 2019. It was actually, I mentioned, I think, in a recent conversation, it was an idea that surfaced on a Chamber of Commerce. GLI has a glide trip they do every year to different cities where they learn, you know, what are you doing great? What's not so great? What can we take from you and then bring it back to our city to make ourselves better? And while we were down there, you know, I always kind of think about, I want to go to a local spot, kind of live how locals do. And I don't want to go to a TripAdvisor or some, you know, kind of large commercialized app to get information, because I'm always afraid whether that detail is going to be correct. So my idea was, if you went into a city, I want to be able to connect personally with the people that live in it and say, hey, you're a foodie in Nashville. Here's the area I'm in. Here's how much money I'm looking to spend. Here's the vibe I'm looking for, the food type. Give me a couple of options that I can think about. And to me, the idea popped in my head, you know, in Louisville, it would be the Lou Guru. You would reach out to a local guru that knew the local community, and you could reach out to them personally, and they could give you some recommendations and help you find a path to, you know, go do something fun, and have a great meal, and create a great memory from that, which, you know, hopefully they look back on the Louisville after that trip and they go tell their friends, and, you know, we grow together because of that. So no one seemed to latch onto it from the chamber, so I decided to do it myself. And it's been a fun journey for me. I'm always looking for a creative outlet where I can do things that are outside the normal 9-to-5 job. And for me, that was it. It was, you know, a passion of mine of knowing and understanding the local food community, and then being able to get that out to the world and share my experience. And always love when people reach out to me and tell me the same kind of things, that they're looking for areas to go have fun, experience the city, and I can give them recommendations. And if I hear positive feedback from them, that, you know, it's kind of all the payment that I need. So it was never done to make money off of, or, you know, go worldwide or do anything like that. It was just a fun project that was something I was passionate about.
Now, you can see that in your posts. I mean, it's got to be fun to photograph the foods, try different things. It's an experience for you and your family to spend time together. And it's an excuse to go out and experience something new. Because I think a lot of people, especially folks that live in various communities, if you're not in Louisville, I think people kind of isolate themselves to their community sometimes. Yeah. And sometimes they never leave the bubble of the area that they're in. And in many of those areas, that's, you know, a lot of chain restaurants, yep, things like that. But Louisville is a really special town for food.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you nailed it. I mean, I think if you kind of work within your bubble that you live in, and, you know, you talked about people going, you know, have you been down to the West End lately? Have you been to the South End lately? Have you been downtown lately? And most people say, no, I don't have a reason to go down there. Why would I go down there? Well, to your point, the local food scene in those areas is the reason that you go there. I mean, there's mom and pop shops all across the city that offer great experiences and great food, but they're not really advertised because that's not where they put their money. But it gives you a reason to go into that area of town, and you end up figuring out that they've got a great park or something else in the community when you're driving by that, you know, could bring you back there. And to me, food's that one element where you can sit down at a table with a lot of different people and have a meal, and it doesn't really matter where you came from or what you believe or what your political stances are. Anybody can share a meal together or a beverage together and enjoy it and appreciate it and talk about it the next time that they get together, and just kind of make that part of the life that they live.
I love it. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot here just a little bit. I have gotten a lot of great tips from Lou Guru over the years. One thing that my wife and I as locals always are asking ourselves is, as a local, where do I go to feel like I'm out of town?
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Because so often we go on these vacations and about half of the fun that we have is trying new restaurants and experiencing new things. And we always come back from these experiences and think, gosh, I bet there's so many of these places in Louisville where I could just take a half a day and feel like a tourist, feel like I'm in a totally different community. For us, for a long time, it was a place near Iroquois Park called the Vietnam Kitchen.
Yeah.
Which really kind of scratched that itch for me. Yeah. Scratched that itch. But do you have another recommendation?
Actually, it's something kind of right down that alley that you were talking about just recently happened in Louisville, which is the Louisville World Fest. So down on the Belvedere, downtown Louisville, it's an amazing group of all these international restaurants that are within our own city, and they set up our own stands all within the same place. And then they also surround that with music and cultural experiences and ways to get to know, you know, where their background is from and their community. But it's a great advertisement to figure out, you know, where are those hidden gems within the city and draws you back to them. But specifically to answer your question, Eden and Kissy is probably one that you should check out. It's authentic Caribbean food. You're going to find jerk chicken that isn't, you know, chicken that somebody threw spices on and threw it into the barbecue. They're actually, you know, creating it the way that authentically should be created. So that'd probably be the one that pops to mind that I'd send you guys to go check out.
We're on it. We're on it for sure.
Yep.
All right. You ready to jump in?
I'm ready.
When I ask you about on the show, I always do a little bit of a sneak peek, right? So I'll give you a couple of questions just to kind of prep and want to get to know you a little bit before the show. And I had no idea the depth of your story.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you being really vulnerable and honest and willing to share some of this story with us. I think it'll help other people. But your story starts in small town Kentucky, and it stretches across continents from, you know, the farm fields of your childhood all the way to the streets of London, England.
Yeah.
It's marked by resilience, creativity, and profound loss. And just like the rest of us, I know you're learning how to live under pressure and maybe even how to be transformed by pressure. So let's lean in, let's take a deep breath, and let's hear the story of Todd.
Sure. Where would you like me to begin? I guess that's always the...
Well, you grew up in Springfield, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Springfield. What population, 2,500 people?
I always think about it in relation to graduating class size. So for me, I think our graduating class size was right around 100 people, 120 people. That gives you some perspective of how small Springfield is. We have one high school, and primarily one kind of traditional middle school and one Catholic middle school, which is where I went, which was St. Dominic's. But yeah, small town, you know, stereotypical, mostly agricultural based, you know, small manufacturing. Originally grew up on a large farm that both my father and his brother shared, where one lived on one side, one lived on the other, had over 1,000 acres at the farm. So we constantly spent a lot of time, you know, on tractors and, you know, running bikes, all those kind of things, going kind of everywhere into the forest and into the creeks and, you know, just exploring as you do as kids. And then also growing up kind of on the backs of tractors and in tobacco fields and in barns. And my dad raised pigs growing up as well as cattle. And eventually through his life, he raised ostriches and hedgehogs and bison and everything that he could imagine. But yeah, spent a lot of my youth in the creeks, you know, in the mud, kind of out in the field working around. But I think I'd mentioned it when I was sharing with you, some of my greatest memories thinking back are just, you know, sitting in that old combine that didn't have air conditioning, you know, late towards the sun going down while he was doing his thing. And I was just kind of hanging out, watching what was going on and soaking it all in. And yeah, spending a lot of time on tailgates and listening to him tell stories to his friends and running errands and going to grab lunch and, you know, kind of being around all the guys as they hung out. So that's really how things started down in Springfield.
Yeah, I had to do a little bit of research on Springfield. I've been there, but fun fact, the greatest name in college football came from Springfield.
Phil Sims.
Phil Sims, but the greatest name? Circling around the Kentucky Hall of Fame, Shipwreck Kelly.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. Shipwreck Kelly. I always look up at that at that jersey.
It's a unique
at
name.
Kroger
it's
Field.
One hard to miss. Yeah.
It is hard to miss. So growing up in Springfield, you had a sister?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah, younger sister, older brother. We were each roughly about 2 years apart, so very close to each other and you know, kind of grew up all commingled within the same cars and transport and farm. And, you know, we never really were away from each other too much growing up.
Yeah. So thinking back on growing up in Springfield, that's a story that I think a lot of people have is kind of being in a small town. It really isn't kind of in the middle of nowhere, right? I mean, it's kind of stuck in between, say, Bowling Green and E-Town and Louisville, Kentucky. But you were really some of the first in your family to kind of travel outside of the Springfield community. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so kind of that common story that you hear. My mom spent, I want to say maybe a semester, a year at St. Catherine's College, which is actually in Springfield. It was a college run by the nuns in that area. But for the most part, I was really the first one out of my immediate family to go to school. So it was a learning experience for me. I knew I wanted to explore outside of the area at that point in time. For me, you know, not really being anywhere, going anywhere, Lexington was, you know, pretty far away and felt like, you know, the ends of the earth for me, but it was a jump into college and trying to figure it out on my own. So I always tell people and remind my kids today, they don't know how good that they have it because I literally spent the first day of college re-registering for all my classes because I didn't realize my financial aid wasn't completed. So they dropped me from every one of my classes. So I kept showing up to what I thought was my schedule and waiting for them to call my name on the roll call in the morning and it never showed up. So I went to the administration office and I was like, something's going wrong. You know, they're not mentioning this. And they're like, oh, we dropped all your classes. You never got your financial aid set up. So I spent the whole first day of college learning what financial aid was, getting it all set up, figuring out how I was going to pay for it and re-registering for all my classes, which at that point, I think everything left was like 8 a.m. So
great way to get started.
It was a learning experience for sure. But I also learned that you'd got a lot of favorable kind of perspective from the teachers when you showed up to those 8 a.m. classes. So the teachers would sometimes slip you an extra, you know, answer to a test or give you a better grade on a quiz because, you know, half the class, especially on Fridays, didn't show up for 8 a.m. And if you were there, you understood that you were there for a reason.
Well, and college was on you too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you had to figure out a way to pay for all of that. When you were going to UK, what'd you think you were going to be when you grow up? Because now you're a pro commercial insurance
guru, right? It's kind of weird. I mean, when I was a little kid, I always liked to draw. So I thought, you know, drawing, architecture, you know, something in that space. For some reason, I always wanted to be an air traffic controller. I don't know why that jumped in my head. But as I grew past that, actually, the odd, weird thing is I wanted to go into insurance on purpose. I always saw, and especially in a small town like Springfield, you know, you look towards those people that are in professions that you admire and you see them living the lives that you would like to see yourself living one day. And I always saw the guys that ran the insurance offices as professional, dressed up, you know, they knew everybody around town. Everybody knew them. They always seemed to be living great, happy lives and had everything that they wanted. So I knew when I went into college, instead of just majoring in business and being one of 500 kids, you know, kind of all fighting for the same job when they got out, you know, I took that path and actually after UK, still lived in Lexington, but switched and went to Eastern Kentucky University because they had an insurance and risk management program. And for me, they had more scholarship money than they had kids to give it to. So I was like, this is a no-brainer. I can stay in business. I can be a little bit more niche in where I'm going, but I can also get my school paid for. So, you know, I always joke that I think my senior year, I had enough scholarship money to get my spring break paid for. And, you know, you're a kid at that age. That's about all you can ask for. I mean, I was living the life. But, Yeah, it was a great experience both between UK and EKU. You know, spent time driving back and forth to Eastern those last couple of years. But I was lucky to meet and latch on to a professor who's since passed away, Dr. Pete Kinsicki. And Pete kind of knew my story. And I think, you know, he looked for kids kind of in that same gamut of, you know, small town, first to college. And he really pushed me to do things that I would have never done on my own. And Pete just, you know, one day just straight up told me, he was like, hey, there's this internship that you're going to apply for. I was like, what are you talking about? I don't care about applying for any internships. And he's like, no, you're going to do it. We're going to sit down together. We're going to go through the application process. And, you know, it's something that you're going to put your name into the hat for. And the cool thing was, I didn't know it at the time, but he was really opening up my eyes to, you know, kind of another chapter that I'd never thought that I'd see. So this internship required me to go live in Colorado for a summer by myself. Fantastic opportunity looking back. They gave me a place to live and an extended stay. They gave me this, you know, great Dodge Caravan as a, you know, free car to drive around. And I was basically a shadow at an insurance company in Colorado. And on the weekends, I would spend, you know, going out and exploring, going to baseball games, going to, you know, into the mountains and kind of doing, you know, everything that you would do if you lived in Colorado for a summer. And then eventually there were a bunch of us around the country that were all competing against each other. And it culminated into an interview with their board of directors in San Francisco that year. And I was ultimately selected for a scholarship to live and work in London, England for a summer. So it was total night and day for what I was used to, and kind of set me on a different path.
Well, you were open to each one of those. You listened. The experience came to you, and you were willing to say, sure, yeah, follow that path.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Now, like I say, I think it was, you know, we were talking about with careers. I'd always look to the people that seemed like they had it, you know, had everything together, and they were living life and happy. And, you know, I used those people to use as mentors to help guide my way through that process. And I was really thankful for Pete looking back. And he was definitely somebody in my life that I appreciated him being there and the time that he was there. Yeah.
Now, you've always said that you and Stephanie, your wife, Stephanie, mm-hmm. are childhood sweethearts, or kind of grew up in the same area. Can you tell us a little bit about that memory?
Yeah, absolutely. I laugh because my daughter, who is now 20, uses it against me now, but back when we first met, I think there was a little bit of an age gap there that, you know, these days probably would be frowned upon. I think I was just getting ready to turn 20 and she was on the verge of turning 17. So I had just left for college. She was still back home in Springfield. And on the weekends when I was home, I was actually still working my same job. So I was working at a full service gas station where you still went out to the car, you pumped the gas, you washed the windshield, you checked the oil, the tires, all that stuff. And I remember, you know, her family, her dad and her mom, and she has a brother and sister, they would all spend time at Murphy Chevron where, you know, I worked. And I remember every time that she, you know, and her family would come in, it just, something struck me about her. She was the most beautiful girl I ever saw. And it was kind of written from there that, you know, we were always going to be together. And gosh, yeah, I think we first started dating in 1996. So several years later, we're still together with three kids and just as happy now as I think we were when we originally met. So it's been fantastic love story.
So let's talk a little bit more about your childhood, because I think it's really fascinating to me. What do you want us to know about you that helps explain who you are today?
Yeah, so a couple different things. You know, one, I talked about the farm and my father and his brothers. You know, if you look back into agriculture within Kentucky, specifically in the 80s, it was an extremely difficult time in that space for anybody that was living off the land, if you will. The economy was terrible. Farming was terrible. Nobody was making money. And you had all these guys that, you know, set their livelihood within the Commonwealth based off of farming that were just trying to find ways to feed their families. And ultimately for a large group that lived around the Washington County, Marion County, Bargetown, Nelson County area, they decided that growing marijuana was going to be, you know, their freedom out of that financial issue. Yeah. They knew how to demand the field. They knew how to grow product. They knew just from some expertise of some of the people that were involved, one of which being Johnny Boone, which is, you know, extremely famous and, you know, was on TV and has had several books written about him.
Run, Johnny, run, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Johnny knew that, you know, Kentucky was on the same parallels as other areas around the globe that grew marijuana and had, you know, the right topography, the right, you know, temperatures. We basically set ourselves up perfectly to be the first, you know, or the best cultivating area, you know, in the U.S. So you took all these guys that, you know, knew what they were doing in agriculture. You had hard financial times. You put those two things together. You know, they started figuring out they could make money from it. And you know, long-term down the road, the term Cornbread Mafia was formed. So if you look through back through that period, it was an amazing story. And, you know, like I say, there's books written about it now, but you've got all these guys that came together, grew a product that at that point in time was forbidden and illegal initially, I think to help raise their families, but, you know, eventually it probably grew out of that and they figured out, you know, they could make more from it. And, you know, one thing became another, and FBI didn't really care for it too much. Drug enforcement didn't care for it too much. They found a lot of these guys and put them in jail, and I think found out along the way that none of them would snitch on each other, which was kind of the famous thing about it, is they had all these guys, you know, arrested. They were trying to bring them together and keep them separate and have them, you know, tell a story about why one of them was involved and why the other one. None of them, you know, would tell on the other, and they all kept to their oath, and they all ended up spending a lot more time in jail than they thought they would. My dad was one of those guys. So a large part of my childhood was spent with him away in prison, and us, you know, taking trips to go visit him in the prisons that he was in. And to me, yeah, I never thought anything else about it. I mean, it was dad, and, you know, something happened and we had to go visit him, and, you know, he was doing what he had to do to get back to us. And thankfully, along the way, we had other family members that stepped in and really helped us as kids, you know, when mom couldn't do it all on her own. So I was blessed to have a great grandmother who lived in the city. My great, you know, she was my grandmother, but she was also great, who was very rooted in her religion and her family. And we ended up moving to town to be closer to her, but I was that latchkey kid. I mean, I spent most of my time in my grandmother's kitchen after grade school, watching her cook dinner and, you know, listening to her stories and watching my grandfather bug her to the point that she was smacking his hand away and telling him to get out of the kitchen. And it was just, you know, finding a different way to secure that love that you needed as a kid from different members of your family.
I loved how you framed that story for us by really helping people understand the time and place at which all this occurred, because I've read the book by Jimmy Higdon. I read it years ago, and I kind of became fascinated with the story. And I've always kind of been perplexed by the, you know, the term Cornbread Mafia, because I've read the story. I have studied into it a little bit. It happened right here in Kentucky. And I don't think there was a lot of mafia about it. These were real people trying to make a living, doing what they knew how to do. And I think that connotation, I think for people to hear the Cornbread Mafia, that they think of it as something that it really wasn't. And I think that mentioning that, you know, there were 70 plus Kentuckians that were rounded up. I think, was it Pickett? I think he just got out in 2011. Yeah. He served 22 years in prison for something that I wonder what those guys think now. That you can go into, you can take a plane to Colorado and go to a store that looks like a, you know, an Apple store and get a menu of marijuana products and hear these guys faced.
Yeah, I think about that every day. I think about how he would have seen the world that we live in today. And to him, he was very much a live and let live kind of guy. So I always remember he said, you know, what's my business is my business, and what's your business is your business. And as long as we keep it that way, we'll never have a problem. So he, you know, you got to do what you got to do to take care of your families. And, you know, he felt like that's what he was doing at that time. I think, unfortunately, you know, he figured out that you could probably make more money off of that long-term than you could from farming. So he didn't quite learn the way that maybe he should have the first time. And unfortunately, he did go back and spend a second stint in jail for the same thing. So it made it difficult. I mean, it was grade school and high school, so he was never really there to see a lot of the traditional stuff growing up. And you know, I just had to find other ways through other family members and other friends' parents to kind of scratch that itch as it came to family.
Yeah, do you ever get to see? I know you played football in high school. Do you ever get to go to any of your games or attend any of that?
No, never got to attend a game. But it was interesting. I feel like, you know, one of the reasons that I played growing up was because of him. And it was because when I talked with the rest of his family that you know, didn't go to jail, one of the things that they told me that stuck to me is he always wanted to play, but his dad, being such a big farmer, would never let his boys play because he always needed them. He needed the hands out in the field.
Oh, wow.
So anybody saying they wanted to take a break off from going to work in the field and go play football, he would, you know, their dad was like, "Wait, there's no way you're not doing it because I need you here." So it was, it was just a kind of a connection that I drew with him. And one of the reasons that I played was because of him.
Yeah. So what was, tell me a little bit, what was life like when he finally got out the second stint? How old were you when he finally got out?
Let's see. He passed in 2000. It was actually Christmas Eve of 2000. Probably 4 or 5 years before that. So I got to spend some time with him, obviously, in some, you know, big years for me, kind of growing up and learning life and getting out.
You're about 20, 21 years old at that time.
Yeah, right around 20, 21 years old. So it was right at the point where, you know, I still needed some conversation from him and guidance on, you know, at that point, you're just questioning, how do you be a man? I mean, you know, how do you develop your life and live your life and do all the things that you're supposed to do and do them in the way that they're supposed to be done? So I guess looking back, you know, it was a kind of a great timing for him to come back and me have that opportunity to chat with him for those couple of years that I did.
And then he tragically passed away at 25?
Yeah. When I was 25, it was Christmas Eve of 2000. We actually received a phone call in the middle of the night and learned that he had a heart attack. And in classic dad fashion, he was in Jamaica getting ready to get married for the third time at, you know, a resort down there where, you know, it kind of fit into his way of life and, you know, what he loved and live and let live. And the culture of Jamaica just kind of connected with him. But yeah, it was kind of a tragic experience, obviously, but, you know, spent Christmas Day that day flying down with one of his friends, getting to the country and figuring out a way to get him back, you know, to the States, which was, you know, surreal and just, you know, one of those things that you never want to wish on anybody else, but, you know, somebody had to be the man of the family to go do it. And, and still have a lot of visions of what, you know, occurred while we were down there and, you know, bringing him back. But yeah, it was just lost too young. He was 52 years old. And I think that was one of the things that resonated when you posted that about turning 50 is I just turned 50 September 12th. And thinking about, you know, I'm at the stage in my life where he passed away 2 years older than I am now, just, you know, has a big impact. And just changes the way that you see things and gives you some perspective on how short life is and how much you need to enjoy it while you're here.
Yeah, I think staring 50 in the face, one of the things that kind of came to me was, you know, this realization that as morbid as it kind of sounds, I think anybody that has grappled with turning 50 realizes that, you know, there's more behind you than there is ahead of you.
Yeah.
And how are we going to make the rest of this life meaningful? I share a story with you, too. My parents were divorced. I think a lot of people have that story. And when I tell the story, I had a great stepfather. I had a great dad. Very different people, extremely different. And the way I tell my story is that I grabbed a little bit of both.
Yeah.
And they were such uniquely different individuals that I turned what many people think of as kind of a negative into a real positive by kind of being able to pick and choose those parts of each one of those father figures in my life that I thought were good and real and meaningful that I could take with me and put in my pocket and carry on my life with. But looking back on your relationship with your father, you know, what do you think you got from him the most?
I think it was always his perspective on things. I mean, he was kind of that ultimate cool hand Luke. So, you know, if you met him, you know, it was kind of never showed his cards. You know, if you got a grin or a smile out of him, it felt like it was earned. His true close friends were extremely true and extremely close. And knowing that you were on the inside, I mean, I think about one of his best friends that I'm still connected with. You know, we talked about earlier social media, but you know, for the great things that it does is connect you with people that you would never be connected with otherwise. So having that opportunity to still stay engaged with one of his best friends, you know, his best friend always said, you know, his hand was his word, and you know, just being able to understand and live by that and try to pass some of that along to my kids has been something that's been meaningful to me. I mean, being able to trust someone for what they say and on face value is such a huge thing these days. I mean, to me, genuine relationships and being able to trust people genuinely is tough to come by. But you know, when you have it, that it's something that's usually important.
Yeah. You shared that with me in some of the pregame huddle that we did. You said one of the hardest lessons from your dad was to never be vulnerable, never trust people. Yet here you are.
Right.
On this podcast, sharing and wrestling with some of these things.
Yeah, I think that's part of turning 50 and looking, as you mentioned, towards what the last chapters look like is, you know, you try to figure out, you know, what different paths do you need to take? I mean, you take everything that you've been given through life and you try to learn from it and build from it and become your own person from it. But at some point you have to live on your own and, you know, live under your own beliefs. And you realize that not everything that, you know, your mentors taught you growing up was exactly right. You know, as you mentioned with having a dad and a stepdad, you take certain pieces of that and you learn to grow from those pieces that you believe in and you live with. And then you start tweaking them to make them your own. So,
well, and I think that goes back to what I was talking about is that you learn so much. You recognize that these people that you looked up to when you were a child were not all that grown up themselves.
Yeah.
And you start to give them grace and mercy for some of the decisions that they made or the ways that they did things. But you take so much from just as much from some of the lessons learned that you don't want to do as the lessons that they taught you that you want to emulate. And one of the things that's really apparent to anybody that knows Todd, that knows you, is that I think some of this experience that you had of not having, being able to spend time with your dad growing up in those pivotal years, you've really, really taken seriously as it relates to your kids. I mean, it is apparent with anyone that you have just decided you're going to be the best dad there is.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me a little bit about, so your three kids, you've got McKenna.
Yeah, McKenna.
McKenna, that's right. Sawyer and Hudson.
Yep.
And did I just see one of them is producing their own music?
Yeah.
No? Yeah. That's Sawyer, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, but he's doing it, is he doing it under alter ego or something?
Yeah, he figured that when you're in the industry, you have to have kind of another stage name or a presence, so... Anthony is his middle name, so he goes by Anthony Melange, and Melange he came up with because it was, I believe, a French word that meant a culmination of a lot of different things. So if you ask him for his inspiration for the record that he just produced, which is coming out soon, he'll relay back to you different genres and musicians that I would have never known that he knew. From 70s to now. And I think he felt like that he was picking pieces of those artists and kind of culminating those into what he thought was most interesting about him. And that's where he developed his record that he came up with. But yeah, Anthony Melange is his stage name, if you will.
So cool. And he's a high schooler, right?
Yeah, he's a senior in high school.
Senior in high school. So what's next for we won't call him Anthony, we'll call him Sawyer.
College obviously is next for him. He's been blessed to have a great mental aptitude, and I think, you know, it's much further along than I ever was at his age. So he has a great opportunity ahead of him to go several different paths when it comes to school. So we're really interested to see where that path takes him. I mean, I don't think he wants to stay in town. I think he wants to explore the world a little bit and get away from Kentucky and find other areas to meet new people and experience things. So your guess is as good as mine right now, but it could be anywhere from East Coast to South to hopefully not too far west. But
well, let's give him a plug, because you can listen to his music on Spotify.
Yeah, everything right now that you can download music onto now. So he's on Apple Music, Spotify, Amazon Music. He just released his first single, Red Wine, which we're all really proud of. We've heard a lot of the other tracks that are coming out. He's fine-tuning them now. And he's much kind of mature and wiser in his age than I thought that he was through a lot of the lyrics and the music that he's put together. But
well, the song's called Red Wine.
Yeah,
certainly he doesn't know what red wine tastes like.
Right? No, you wouldn't think, but you know,
yeah, you never know.
I think what we discovered later on down the road, and we put two and two together, that the song was actually about an older girl that he dated for a while, and some of the lyrics, you know, now make sense, and we're worried about how long we left them together in the basement.
That's fun. You know, I find myself sounding like one of those old curmudgeons, just like my parents probably sounded, and complaining about kids these days. And then I see kids like Sawyer. I see kids like McKenna and Hudson, my daughter, my son. And I tell you what, there's some hope.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
really some hope. And I think one thing that is fascinating about some of these kids is your son in this particular situation. I think you could name individual things that your other children have done. But just as we're talking about Sawyer, really reminds me of my daughter. And that was, you know, I think they feel empowered to go chase their dreams. You've set up that opportunity to say, hey, if you want to record music, if you want to go down to Nashville and put yourself out there and do it, throw it out there in the universe. And yeah. And it feels like they have so much opportunity to do that. And a lot of these kids are doing that, and they're going to become something really special. Yeah, I can't wait to see where
equally scary and equally cool, because you don't want them to fail, but you do want them to fail. And you want them to be able to kind of, you know, do more than they think that they're capable of doing. But you know that also means that it's going to come along with some heartbreak and, you know, some punishment along the way. But you hope that they learn from that the way that they should, and it makes them stronger human beings going forward.
That's the tough part of parenting, the way I think that you and I parent similarly, and that is it's so heartbreaking. Because you know you can't be there to, you know, you can be, I think the term I used on my podcast with Peyton was, you can be the lighthouse. And you can be stand firm and show them the way. You can always be the place they can come back to, but you can't take all the hits for them.
Yeah, that's right. Hard. You have to learn how to fall.
Okay, let's move on. There's been some other pivotal things in your life that have happened, moments, events, insights that you've learned that have helped you become the person that you are. Anything else you want to share with us there?
No, I think I'd mentioned, you know, in the interview process before we got together, you know, one of the other big turning points in life was we unfortunately lost my sister at a very young age. So she unfortunately died in a car accident going home to see my mom in Springfield. And kind of oddly enough, my wife, Stephanie, and I were getting married 3 months later, 3 months after that. And she was actually going home to help my mom with the wedding planning. So it was, you know, 4 years after the passing of my dad. And obviously she was the baby and the one that everybody loved the most, as they should in the family. And losing her along the way, you know, just, I guess I would have been 29, just after losing dad, was really difficult. And it just kind of makes you reevaluate things and how you spend time with your own family. And, you know, I still see a lot of her and my daughter now. And my daughter spends a lot of time going back down to Springfield to see my mom and stepdad and hanging out on the farm and being around the horses just like my sister would. So it's going to come full circle with that.
Yeah, that's tough. Your father and your sister within a kind of a 4-year period of time.
Yeah.
I think, how do you think that that shaped you, or what did you get from that experience, you think, that, you know, allowed you to have the resilience to press through that?
I think it was a little bit, you know, kind of good and bad. I mean, from a bad that turned good perspective, you know, I think it kind of caused me to have a little bit of a hard shell, which I then turned to use in my personal life on, you know, growing professionally and business-wise, and kind of determined that I was going to do something that, you know, I felt was beyond my means and, you know, have success personally, no matter, you know, who was around me and who was trying to stop me from doing that. So I use it as a little bit of a motivator to push me forward and kind of put up a shell around other people, I feel like, because of that. But, you know, I'm starting to grow out of that, I think, more and more now, and seeing the positive side of it is it also kept me in touch with, you know, my wife and my kids, and has caused me to focus on, you know, finding opportunities to make the little things big. You know, not missing events, not missing opportunities to see your kids do things in their life that you could easily say, you know, hey, it's just another practice. It's just another game. It's, you know, just another fill in the blank that, you know, I'm going to see again down the road. You know, kind of latching on and grabbing hold of those things and making sure that you're there to be part of them, because you never know when they're going to go away.
Well, I think one of the questions I asked you was, you know, have you personally bridged any ancient practices, like some of the things that we've talked about on this podcast, meditation or contemplation, spiritual rituals, things like that? And your answer was, man, I haven't, but I'd really love to learn more. And I think, honestly, you're doing this, which is just living in the present moment, is something that I think so many people struggle with.
Yeah.
They're constantly worrying about the future that doesn't exist and creating worry for things that haven't happened yet, or they're ruminating on the past. And it feels like you've really dug in, whether you recognize it or not, to finding each moment, finding joy in the small things, sharing a meal with your kids, trying something new, experience, being at a soccer game. It seems like you've been at thousands of those over the last five or 6 years. I think you're doing more of that than what you really think that you're doing.
I appreciate that. Sometimes it's good to get perspective from how other people see you and how you're doing things in life. So that means a lot. I think the most difficult thing that I find with exploring, you know, those things that you mentioned was, where do you start? I mean, it's such a vast array of information, you know, digging in to find places to, where do you spend your time to get the most out of it, is to me the scariest thing. So, you know, maybe that's one of the things that we can take away from this as we, you know, go our separate ways once we're done chatting, is, you know, anything that you can provide to help give some guidance and where does one start in that space, I think would be beneficial.
Yeah. Well, I started on that journey maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I think that it starts with taking one moment, 60 seconds, maybe when you wake up in the morning before you get your day started, before you jump into your cup of coffee and hit the ground running and all the responsibilities and the things that you have, and taking 60 seconds to count your blessings, to be grateful, and to take a few moments just to pause and reflect on what your life is like today. I think that if 15-year-old Todd saw 50-year-old Todd, he'd be awful proud of what you've accomplished. And I think you can just take the time to recognize that and look for the small moments of joy, you know, throughout your day. For me, sometimes that's, you know, when I'm walking to my car on my way to work, I'll pick my head up and happen to catch a sunrise, or, you know, some bird feathers that have fallen on the ground that I pick up and collect in a jar. It doesn't have to be much.
Yeah.
When people talk about meditation, that's really helped me, but boy, it was hard to get started. I started off with a, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of just trying to pause and just recognize what thoughts were swirling through my head and trying to find the space in between those thoughts or not grasp onto them and let them kind of control me. But just take a couple of minutes, and over time, and they call it practice because it's hard as hell to do at the beginning. You know, I've gotten to the point where, you know, I can sit pretty comfortably for 30 or 45 minutes and just kind of be, and it's refreshing to me because boy, you know, life is tough.
Yeah, no. And I think we can use that even more now. I mean, I feel like I can't even sit in front of the TV and enjoy it anymore because I'm worried about what's going on my phone next to me. I mean, it's almost like I don't have enough stimulation to even keep me satisfied. But to your point, I mean, I was talking about, I like to go on walks to try to get a little bit of exercise now. And when I do, I don't take music or anything else with me. I just try to kind of listen to myself and feel what's going on around me. And, you know, that's just, it's weird because I don't feel like I get enough of that opportunity to do it in a normal day. So,
well,
I appreciate that advice.
Absolutely. And I think that you sharing and being vulnerable and sharing some of your story is exactly what this whole podcast is about. My hope is that there are other people. We don't have thousands and thousands of listeners, but hopefully we will at some point. And only hopefully because I think that someone's going to take something in your story that you've shared with us today and find meaning and share in that experience with you. I think that matters a lot. One of the things that you shared with me that has been a big pivotal point in your life is being diagnosed with kidney disease.
Yeah.
Is it CKD?
It's actually, I just lost my train of thought on it, but it's degenerative kidney disease over time, which I've been managing for, I think I told you originally, but I don't remember how long it's been. Actually found out because I was changing employers at the time, and you know, I had to take blood work for life insurance, and something came back on the blood work that didn't seem normal, so I had to go back for a biopsy and just kind of randomly figured out that I had kidney disease. But yeah, it's been, I guess, 15 plus years now that I've been going to see a nephrologist and kind of dealing with getting my blood work tested and trying to figure out how good or bad of a situation that I'm in. But it's changed definitely the way that I've seen things on life. And you talk about getting a kick in the gut to, you know, wanting to be there and cherish every moment and, you know, spending a lot more of your money on experience versus things. I think that's one of the things that I draw from it is, you know, if I can find a way to go do more, be more, you know, experience more with my family, I'm going to take every minute that I can and fill every minute of it I can with, you know, time with them and being around them.
Yeah. For other listeners who are struggling with kidney disease as well, like what would you tell them? How have been some of the ways that you've been able to cope or manage with the condition?
Sure. IPA nephropathy. That's what I was looking for. I think obviously you have to go out and seek medical attention and try to get someone that you're comfortable talking to. I've been through a couple of different doctors just trying to find one that I have a good fit with, you know, listening to the experts, doing research on your own. For a long period, my wife actually joined the kidney board here locally to be able to provide support through nonprofit and be engaged with what they're doing for advocacy and, you know, trying to get laws changed and help patients that are involved. But two, you know, you got to take care of yourself. I wasn't always doing a great job of that. I kind of had a bit of an epiphany almost 2 years ago and decided to change, you know, how I was going to face my health through eating and exercise and kind of managing that side of things. I mean, I think all too often these days, and I was in the same rut, was, you know, you try to find what medication is going to solve the problem for you. And while they're great and we make advancements that are making us live longer and healthier lives, you know, I think that I came to the realization that I could do a lot better for myself just finding positive ways to eat and positive ways to take care of myself healthily through my health that would have just as big of an impact. And I've seen that change over the last year through, you know, eliminating or reducing medications, more positive test results, feeling more energy, you know, just kind of being healthier and feeling healthier.
Well, and over a, with a lot of hard work and over a significantly, you know, expanded period of time, you've lost over 100 pounds?
Yeah, it's right at 115 pounds over the last year and 10 months.
For the food guru.
Yeah.
That's got to be tough.
Yeah, that's quite of a ironic statement, isn't it?
There's a lot of people that are suffering from, you know, their weight.
Yeah.
And is there any advice you would share with them? I mean, I think it seems really daunting, kind of like we were talking about meditation. It's like you don't have to sit down for 45 minutes and hire a spiritual guide to lead you on the journey. You can do it 1 minute at a time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's trying to live both lives at the same time has been interesting, but there's always alternatives. And it doesn't mean you have to be miserable. I think when I started out on my journey, I did a lot of fasting. I cut carbs. I focused a lot more on what my proteins were and what I was putting into my body. And I kind of started my process that way until I ultimately figured out that I was plateauing and had to find another path to kind of work that in. And I think that's when I started picking weights back up again, which is something that I hadn't really done since, just after high school, and was something that I enjoyed. I mean, I always think back, running and, doing cardio things wasn't really something that I enjoyed doing, but I would love getting into the weight room with my buddies and, just kind of vegging out and listening to music and just forgetting about everything else that goes on in the day and walking away feeling like a better person. So I got to a point where I was working that within my routine. And then slowly as I got to a health stance where I felt positive about myself and where I was, I'd try to start working back in, having a piece of pizza, but not having four pieces of pizza, drinking a beer, but not drinking six beers. Or if I'm going to go out and have a nice meal, it's okay to take leftovers home. You can have a nice steak and also have steak for the next couple of days at home too. Just, you don't have to eat it all at one time. So not making life where you're making yourself miserable, but making changes enough where it's positive for you and you can feel like that you're still living life without, going through depression health-wise and feeling like that everybody else is living this fantastic life that you don't get to live. There's kind of a happy line to work on both sides of there.
Yeah, I have people ask me that too, because I always try to do my part to stay healthy, and they ask me kind of the secret, and I say, well, I eat donuts as a, every so often kind of thing. If I'm out of town and I'm down at 30A and there's a great donut shack or whatever, and there's a really, really good donut, I might eat one every once in a while, but I don't do it every single day. And I think it's just, it makes those moments when you do have something really good and really special that much more meaningful, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so one of the things that I always ask guests, and I'm going to ask you now, is, we've talked a lot about your journey. We've talked a lot about the twists and turns along the way. We've talked a lot about, the role that you have as a dad and as a husband. But knowing what you know now, if you had the chance to go back and whisper one sentence to your past self, maybe you're 15, 20 years old, what would you say to that, Todd?
Yeah, I think I'd maybe even mentioned it earlier. It's make the little things big, take the opportunity to, see those small things that you mentioned and think about and cherish how big they are in your life. I mean, it's like your kid taking their first step. It's, a minute piece of your life from a time perspective, but it's a huge step forward, for the kid and for you. But it's not just that, it's, spending time looking at your kid's face when they're out playing sports, not really worrying about how well they're doing or not doing, but just kind of enjoying whether, they're determined or they're happy or they're frustrated, and soaking that piece in and then taking those mental pictures to draw on later on down the road. Just finding those opportunities to, again, sit down with your family for a meal, travel together, do all those kind of things that you say you want to do one day, and then the time's gone and you got no chance to do them again. Finding the opportunity to look at those little things and making sure that they're the big things in your life.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I started this podcast and one of the things that I'm really trying to do is to preserve these conversations in the record of time. You know, this may not be the Joe Rogan show, but it'll live on the internet for a long time. And there'll be a 75-year-old Todd that might want to sneak back and listen to this version. Any advice that you would give the, you know, what do you want to tell your future self?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, give yourself some grace. You know, be proud of what you accomplished in your life and give other people grace at the same time. You don't always have to be right in all those scenarios. And, you know, it's great to be able to look back and enjoy the fact that you gave other people a chance. You know, even when you thought maybe that they weren't worthy of that chance, finding ways to be vulnerable when you didn't think that you could be vulnerable. And I hope that, you know, I can look back and think that I did a good job raising the kids and, you know, making my wife happy and trying to find ways to bring a little bit of joy to people around me.
Love it, Todd. You know, I've watched you for, I guess we talked about it now, 15 years, mostly through social media and through, you know, casual get togethers. I think we've been to a Lou City soccer game or a UK football game together. Those things that you really cherish and love. And, I've learned so much just watching you, and taking an example from you. And so, I want to thank you for being on the show today for sure.
For sure. No, I appreciated you reaching out and giving me the opportunity. And, I think we'd mentioned from the beginning, we don't always get a chance to revisit our life and see where we've came from and think about how it's impacted us and the opportunity to be vulnerable and get things out there and let other people know that it's okay to share those stories and talk with other people. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be through a text message or a post and a comment online. You can actually sit down and have a conversation with somebody and learn some things and learn things about yourself. So it is a great opportunity for me to have a little therapy session and think back on a lot of great memories.
Well, thanks for your openness today. It's hard being vulnerable. It takes courage. Thanks for sharing not just your milestones, but, you know, the weight you've carried and the meaning that you've drawn from that. So for our listeners, if you're listening right now and you feel that weight pressing down, whether it's your expectations of age, the grief of loss, or just the daily grind, I hope this conversation with Todd reminds you that you're not alone. Pressure doesn't crush you. It can also redefine you. Todd's story reminds us that the little things, the bike rides, the meals shared, the sideline moments with your kiddos, are not little at all. Those are the big things. As always, the story of us is about more than one person's journey. It's about our stories connecting across time and culture, reminding us that we're all part of something larger. So as we close, I invite you to reflect, what weight are you carrying around now? And how might that weight be shaping you into something stronger, kinder, maybe even more radiant? You can read more on the blog post that we mentioned earlier, Under Pressure, Coping with the Weight of 50, at thestoryofusproject.com. Until next time, keep living the questions, keep finding beauty in the ordinary, and remember, your story matters. Todd, thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Peace be with you.